you kindly look with me quickly at the last part of Sartre's essay, Existentialism. We had come to page 24. Paul. They do in the instructional. Yes. We had come to page 24 of the essay on existentialism. By the way, we welcome I.J. Kim as an auditor to our class. I hope that I.J. has received all the materials thus far. Okay, good. Who was taking for I.J.? Good. Thank you, O.J. Sartre was speaking about persons freely choosing things which they then affirmed as values. And that in choosing things that they affirmed as values, they chose them not only for themselves, but for all men. And this brings about an anguish in the responsibility that it brings upon individuals in the choices that they're making. On page 25, he says, line 3, all leaders know this anguish. And then skip down 3 lines. It implies that they envisage a number of possibilities, and when they choose one, they realize that it has value only because it is chosen. Next full paragraph. Second term, when we speak of forlornness, a term Heidegger was fond of, we mean only that God does not exist and that we have to face all the consequences of this. Page 26. The last paragraph, the one that begins, the existentialist. The existentialist thinks it's very distressing that God does not exist because all possibility of finding values in a heaven of ideas disappears along with him. There can no longer be an a priori good, a priori before experience, since there is no infinite and perfect consciousness to think it. Nowhere is it written that the good exists, that we must be honest, that we must not lie, because the fact is we are on a plane where there are only men. Dostoevsky said, if God didn't exist, everything would be possible. That is the very starting point of existentialism. Now, you'll remember that Dostoevsky did not hold Sartre's atheistic view. Dostoevsky held to theism. But he says, theoretically, hypothetically, if God didn't exist, everything would be possible. That is the very starting point of existentialism. Everything is permissible if God does not exist. And as a result, man is forlorn because neither within him nor without does he find anything to cling to. The next paragraph, if existence really does precede essence, there's no explaining things away by reference to a fixed and given human nature. In other words, there's no determinism. Man is free. Man is freedom. If God does not exist, we find no values or commands to turn to which legitimize our conduct. 2 lines farther, we are alone with no excuses. Page 28, the first new paragraph. The existentialist, jump down 4 lines, thinks that man with no support and no aid is condemned every moment to invent man. Page 34. the third term. As for despair, the last paragraph at the bottom of page 34. As for despair, the term has a very simple meaning. It means that we shall confine ourselves to reckoning only with what depends upon our will or on the ensemble of probabilities which make our action possible. Page 40. Second line. If people throw up to us our works of fiction in which we write about people who are soft, weak, cowardly, and sometimes even downright bad, it's not because these people are soft, weak, cowardly, or bad, because if we were to say, as Zola did, that they are that way because of heredity, the workings of environment, society, because of biological or psychological determinism, people would be reassured. They would say, well, that's what we're like. No one can do anything about it. But when the existentialist writes about a coward, he says that this coward is responsible for his cowardice. He's not like that because he has a cowardly heart or lung or brain. He's not like that on account of his physiological makeup, but he's like that because he has made himself a coward by his acts. There's no such thing as a cowardly constitution. There are nervous constitutions, there's poor blood, as the common people say, or strong constitutions. But the man whose blood is poor is not a coward on that account. For what makes cowardice is the act of renouncing or yielding. A constitution is not an act. The coward is defined on the basis of the acts he performs. People feel in a vague sort of way that this coward we're talking about is guilty of being a coward, and the thought frightens them. What people would like is that a coward or a hero be born that way. See, that would absolve them of responsibility. Last three lines of page 41. What the existentialist says is that the coward makes himself cowardly, that the hero makes himself heroic. There's always a possibility for the coward not to be cowardly anymore and for the hero to stop being heroic. Last full paragraph, line 2. We're still charged with immuring man, putting man in a jail, in a prison, in his private subjectivity. Next line. Subjectivity of the individual is indeed our point of departure, and this for strictly philosophic reasons. Not because we are bourgeois, but because we want a doctrine based on truth and not a lot of fine theories full of hope but with no real basis. There can be no other truth to take off from than this: I think, therefore I exist. The cogito ergo sum of René Descartes. There we have the absolute truth of consciousness becoming aware of itself. Page 44, line 3. The subjectivity that we have thus arrived at, and which we have claimed to be truth, is not a strictly individual subjectivity, for we have demonstrated that one discovers in the cogito not only himself, but others as well. The cogito, shorthand for cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Page 45, the first new paragraph. If it is impossible to find in every man some universal essence which would be human nature, yet there does exist a universal human condition. There's no such thing as a human nature, but there is a universal human condition. Drop down 2, 4, 6, 7 lines. What does not vary is the necessity for him to exist in the world, to be at work there, to be there in the midst of other people, and to be mortal there. That is what Sartre calls the finally decisive limitation to human existence, death. Page 50. First new paragraph, line 3, in other words. I ask whether anyone has ever accused an artist who has painted a picture of not having drawn his inspiration from rules set up a priori, prior to experience. Has anyone ever asked, what painting ought he to make? It is clearly understood that there is no definite painting to be made, that the artist is engaged in the making of his painting, and that the painting to be made is precisely the painting he will have made. It is clearly understood that there are no a priori aesthetic values, but that there are values which appear subsequently in the coherence of the painting, in the correspondence between what the artist intended and the result. Nobody can tell what the painting of tomorrow will be like. That's rather prophetic if one looks at the Picasso exhibit at the Art Museum here in Philadelphia. No one can tell what the painting of tomorrow will be like. Painting can be judged only after it has once been made. What connection does that have with ethics? We are in the same creative situation. Page 51, line 3. The same holds on the ethical plane. Jump two lines. We cannot decide a priori what there is to be done. Then drop down 2, 4, 7 lines from the bottom. Man makes himself. He isn't ready-made at the start. In choosing his ethics, he makes himself, and the force of circumstances is such that he cannot abstain from choosing one. Page 57. He has listed some objections to the doctrine of existentialism. And at the bottom of page 57, the last new paragraph, the third objection is the following. Jump two lines. Fundamentally, values aren't serious since you choose them. My answer to this is that I'm quite vexed that that's the way it is. But if I've discarded God the Father, there has to be someone to invent values. You've got to take things as they are. Moreover, to say that we invent values means nothing else but this. Life has no meaning a priori. Before you come alive, life is nothing. It's up to you to give it a meaning. And value is nothing else but the meaning that you choose. Next new paragraph. I've been reproached for asking whether existentialism is humanistic. Jump down three lines. Actually, the word humanism has two very different meanings. By humanism, one can mean a theory which takes man as an end and as a higher value. Page 59, last new paragraph. But there's another meaning of humanism. Fundamentally, it is this. Man is constantly outside of himself. In projecting himself, in losing himself outside of himself, he makes for man's existing. And on the other hand, it is by pursuing transcendent goals, goals beyond himself, that he is able to exist. Jump down four lines. There is no universe other than a human universe, the universe of human subjectivity. Next to the last line on page 60. Existentialism is nothing else than an attempt to draw all the consequences of a coherent atheistic position. Jump four lines. Existentialism isn't so atheistic that it wears itself out, showing that God doesn't exist. Rather, it declares that even if God did exist, that would change nothing. There you've got our point of view. Well, a message comes through rather clearly in this essay. Aside from the denial of the existence of God and the affirmation of atheism, he draws the implications in this fashion. In his context, since God doesn't exist, there are no absolutes. Everything is what we choose to make it. So in the realm of epistemology, theory of knowledge, there's no such thing as truth except what we make it. There's no absolute truth. In the realm of morality, ethics, there are no absolute standards. except those we choose to affirm. In the realm of values, aesthetics, there are no absolute standards except those we choose to affirm. I say, there you have it. There you have it. Sartre rejects all determinism. That means he not only rejects all absolutes, but he rejects the very concept of a human nature which has any content, any substance. Now, I gave you a copy of The Wall. Now, the first page isn't The Wall. The first page is Existentialism from Dostoevsky to Sartre. But on the second page of that handout, at the bottom, the short story begins, The Wall. This short story gives us, in fictional form, the most powerful emotional impact of existentialism. And so it's considered to be a very helpful introduction to the mood, if it were, as it were, of existentialism. Some young men are engaged in the Spanish Civil War. They have been caught, taken prisoner. Many prisoners are being executed as traitors to the government. They are on the side of the resistance, these three young men. And they're being held in a cellar. They're going to be taken up the next morning, perhaps, placed against a wall and shot. And the story relates the experience that they're going through that night. What they're thinking about, what they're facing, what they're feeling. How they try to come to grips with the idea that they're going to be stood up against the wall and shot. They're wondering how it's going to happen and how will it come? Will they be shot in the eyes? How will it happen? They're trying to face that. And all the other things that they've been interested in and concerned about fade away into nothingness. All those other concerns look petty now against this finally decisive limitation to human existence, death. Curiously enough, it's like an O. Henry story because the hero or anti-hero, as you will, has told one of the other resistance fighters to hide in a certain place and not leave there, stay there, be safe there. They question each of the prisoners to try to find out additional information, try to find out other names of resistance people, traitors, quote. And he tells them some wild story. He tells them some wild story about where this other fellow is that they question him closely about. Meanwhile, he knows he's hiding at so-and-so's house safely. So the soldier kicks him and tells him, if you're not telling the truth, it's going to go hard with you. Well, he doesn't care anymore because he's facing death. What more can they do to him? They're going to stand him up against a wall and shoot him. What does he owe them in terms of telling them the truth? I mean, it doesn't matter what he tells them. Nothing is going to change anything. So he tells them this wild story. He even chuckles about this wild story himself. The two other friends are taken out in the morning and they're shot. He hears the sound of the shooting. Every morning it starts shooting, 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 shooting. And every shot punctuates his consciousness and burns into his brain. They take him up and they take him out into a yard, and there are other people in the yard, and somebody comes up to him and says, "Where? How did you get free?" He says, "I don't know why they released me. I have no idea." And then he asked the other person, "Where is so-and-so, this person who was hiding?" And he said he did a dumb thing. He left the place where he was hiding. He says, "Where did he go?" He says he went into the graveyard. Well, this is what he had told the soldiers. He told the soldiers that this fellow was going in the graveyard and hiding in a certain tomb there. And here this fellow had done that very thing and they caught him there. So they released him. Well, the thing struck him as so funny. The absurdity of it. See, that's the idea. The absurdity of it struck him as so funny that he laughed and laughed and he couldn't stop laughing. That's the emotional impact of the short story, The Wall. The idea that if you let society dictate how you're going to live, you'll never be free. That if you want to gain freedom, liberty, to use Heidegger's term, authentic existence, then you must be willing to accept the consequences of the way you live, the way you choose to live. And once you accept those consequences, even the ultimate consequence, death, then you can choose to be and to live the way you want to. You don't let anybody tell you how to live. You don't let society dictate to you the mode of your life. Once you accept that, then you can live and be free, as long as you're willing to accept the consequences. Well, he was willing in this story to accept the consequences. And he learned that he could be free once he accepted death. He could laugh at the soldiers. He could see funny things. When a rat runs out between the soldier's boots, he can laugh at the rat. I mean, he can laugh at the pompous way the soldiers are behaving. The idea that they have such authority and they can whip people around and shoot them and so forth. And he knows that they're going to die too someday, or maybe sooner. The emotional impact of the story is very powerful. It underscores the existentialist concept, authentic existence. Sartre put that into effect in his own life. He chose to live in certain ways that were not that were frowned upon by the community. But he chose to live that way, as he considered it, authentically and consistently. Now, there is something in there that is of value. There is something in existentialism that has value. And we have to try to sort that out. There's a lot that's not, that doesn't have value, but there are some things that have value. I've tried to sketch out a typical existentialist position on pages 48 and 49. As you saw by the essay, Existentialism, Sartre emphasizes human responsibility up to the hilt. You're responsible for what you are and what you're becoming. If you let other people decide for you, in effect, you are deciding. You're deciding to let them decide your existence. He stresses the idea that since you are free to decide your own existence, then the only way to achieve authentic existence is to actualize your freedom. Choose, not let others choose for you. And he says that when you let other people decide for you how you're going to live, that's unauthentic existence. But if you get caught up in the idea of choosing what is good by other people's standards, then you're falling into the trap once again that existentialism tries to get people out of. For Sartre, there is no system of good, and you choose what is good according to the system. You can see it's a revolt against the establishment, a revolt against the system. All systems. There isn't any reason to choose this way rather than that way. There's no reason. You provide the reason by choosing this way rather than that way. Will that make you happy? No guarantees. No guarantees. But there is, as we said, the finally decisive limitation to man's freedom, which is death. If you're willing to accept death at any time, in any form, you can be free. I've sketched out some recent trends in existentialist philosophy. Not necessary to go over that. You've read that. But we should quickly look at Rudolf Bultmann. And you've read this material, so I don't have to go over it. You've read why Bultmann was able to gain the advantage over Barthes, and why so many of Barthes' disciples defected and went over into the Bultmannian camp. And some of those quotations on page 52. By Ernst Fuchs of Marburg and Emil Brunner. And Oscar Kuhlmann. Barthes wrote one short article entitled Rudolf Bultmann, ein Versuch ihn zu verstehen. Rudolf Bultmann, an attempt to understand him. Of course, a lot of people couldn't understand Barthes, you understand? I thought it was significant, and I mention it here on page 52 near the bottom, that although he was a professor of New Testament at Marburg, when he retired, he was made emeritus professor of theology. That's very interesting. Very interesting. He had much more impact in theology than he had in New Testament, although he wrote a considerable amount of material in New Testament. When Carl Henry visited Rudolf Bultmann after Bultmann's retirement, and Bultmann was seeing such a vast defection of his own former disciples, all of his former disciples, well, not all, but a good many of them were leaving. Carl Henry asked, Herr Bultmann, he said, Where are your former disciples? And Volkmann said, they're all my disciples. They're all my disciples. No former disciples. I've tried to sketch out the theology of Rudolf Volkmann. Volkmann used Martin Heidegger's philosophy of human existence, ontology particularly, to help him understand Christian existence. And he felt, as I mentioned in the notes, that Heidegger understood Christian existence better than Paul did and expressed it more cogently in these terms of authentic versus unauthentic existence, as opposed to spirit and flesh. You notice Volkmann's basic principles, you've read those. Some of them are similar to Barth's. God is wholly transcendent, rashly unknowable. He's always free, even from his own being, similar to Barth, but with a particular emphasis on rejection of all determinisms. God is always subject, never object, similar to Barth. And then Revelation number 5 on page 53 is kerygmatic. Kerygmatic. Keruso, the Greek word means, the verb means to proclaim or to announce. Keruso. And Volkmann was very concerned with proclamation, the New Testament message. What is the New Testament message? That God has acted decisively for man's salvation in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. That sounds good. That sounds good. Now, there is a bit of a problem with that, because when you look at that statement and say, what is the historical value of the things contained in the statement? Or if you want to put it more broadly, what's the cash value of the items, the key items in the statement? Volkmann held that there were just two facts about Christ of which we could be historically certain. First, that Jesus lived, and second, that Jesus died under the governorship of Pontius Pilate. Of those two, we can be certain. Of nothing else can we be historically certain. No. No. So, when he says that God has acted decisively for man's salvation in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, that's heavily loaded theologically, that statement. What is the kerygma? Volkmann's view has been called kerygmatic theology. What is the kerygma, the message? The proclamation of the act of God in Jesus Christ as the possibility of his act in the here and now. God has acted decisively for man's salvation. We proclaim that, and we proclaim that it's possible now, here, for man to be saved, for this act to take place. Revelation is Geschichte, same as Barth. Truth is found in the revelation encounter, similar to Barth. Faith is irrational response to the kerygma, same as Barth, except for the replacement of revelation with kerygma. And then the New Testament is a human witness in mythological form to divine revelation. Now, what does that mean? In the article which you read, New Testament and Mythology by Rudolf Bultmann, Bultmann sets forth his project. Rudolf Bultmann, New Testament and Mythology. In these courses, by the way, in theology over the years, I have found it helpful to go as much as possible with statements from the people themselves, the theologians, the biblical scholars who hold these various views, and let them say it in their own words. So we're reading what they say, rather than merely our interpretation of it. And you've read this, New Testament and Mythology, the mythological element in the message of the New Testament and the problem of its reinterpretation. What's the problem? What's the task? Well, quite simply, the New Testament is written in the language of mythology. The New Testament message of the decisive act of God in Christ has been mythologized. It's been put into a first century mythological framework or setting. It's been couched in that kind of a framework. That's the vehicle in which the kerygma comes. So when we read the New Testament, what are we reading? We're reading a gospel, a kerygma, which is in mythical form. Now, what does he mean by mythical form? Some years ago, one of my colleagues, Dr. Gary Cohen, and I had opportunity to take a trip to Israel, and we had a fun time because we planned our own itinerary. We rented a car and we stayed as long as we wished in this place or that place or the other place. Well, it was shortly after the Six-Day War, only 6 or 7 months after it. Things were pretty tense. We had occasion to move on one part of our journey from Tiberias down to Jerusalem and went through occupied West Bank. That was interesting. From time to time, we picked up soldiers and so forth and gave them a ride here or there, which I would never do here in the United States, interestingly enough. But we picked up soldiers. And I remember one bright young fellow, and we got to talking because he asked us what we did. And Dr. Cohen was in New Testament, I was in theology. And he immediately went on the defensive and said, well, he says, that's all myth. And so we tried gently to explain to him what we understood as to the truth value of the New Testament. We tried to find out what he meant by myth, of course. Myth. What does Bultmann mean by myth? What does he mean that the gospel is mythologized in the New Testament? By myth, Bultmann means the attempt to express otherworldly realities in this worldly terms and concepts. That's myth. You try to express otherworldly realities in this worldly terms and concepts. That's myth. That is the result of that. Well, you can see that Bultmann not only held, from your reading of this essay, not only held that the first century presentation of the gospel had been mythologized, but that the first century writers expressed in this worldly terms the gospel, but according to their pre-scientific, obsolete worldview understanding. In a first century worldview, that was an essential part of their mythologizing of the kerygma. And Bultmann said, what we have to do is demythologize the kerygma. What does that mean? We have to take the kerygma, the gospel, out of the first century worldview setting, and we have to put it into a 20th century setting. In a very real sense, we not only have to demythologize, but then what we actually wind up doing is remythologizing. We remythologize. We put it into a 20th century worldview. And Bultmann felt that the contribution that he made in this whole project was to explicitly recognize that it was necessary in each century and in each generation, it was necessary to recognize that the gospel is always couched in a mythological worldview. So if you jump from the 1st to the 16th century, or the 1st to the 20th century, or the Lord willing, the 1st to the 22nd century, you've always got to demythologize the gospel and then remythologize the gospel in the particular setting in which you find yourself. The problem, of course, is what do you do after that? What's the next thing you do? Or what's the purpose, which is something similar, what's the purpose of this demythologizing and remythologizing? Bultmann said, to help human beings achieve authentic existence. That's the purpose. That's what the gospel's all about, to help human beings achieve authentic existence. In other words, to liberate, to free human beings. So that I suggest at the bottom of page 54 that Bultmann's theological method may be represented by these four steps. The application of the method of the history of religion to the New Testament. The application of the form historical method of biblical criticism to the synoptics. Then the Entmythologisierung, the demythologizing, and then the existential interpretation of the demythologized message, the kerygma. By the way, anticipating the possibility that you may wonder a little bit about the history of religion and the form, historical method of biblical criticism, although some of you hermeneutic people already know what that's all about, I would mention an article which appeared in Themelius in 1989. By Gordon Wenham, W-E-N-H-A-M, entitled The Place of Biblical Criticism in Theological Study. very helpful survey of the various kinds of criticism, the various kinds of hermeneutics that pertain to what's going on today. And he talks about text criticism and philology and linguistics, literary criticism in terms of genre criticism, historical criticism, source criticism. Redaction criticism. And some other things. It's just a survey article, but it's very helpful. Gordon Wenham, The Place of Biblical Criticism in Theological Study. I won't dwell on that. I just mentioned the article in passing in case you'd like to look at it. I'm trying to find the place that you're referring to. Yeah, Heidegger, not Goldman. I wondered about that when you said it. I was puzzled. Yeah, well, very much so. I don't know the historical circumstances of his relationship to the Barman Declaration. Yes, Brian.
How did Goldman view old?
That's another step removed, really bound in historical criticism. Of course, he's New Testament, so you have to understand his interest in the New Testament and his emphasis on it. But that would be even more involved in the backwash of all these people in the higher criticism. They all were influenced by the higher criticism. And still influence today most of the European scholars. A lot has been said and written in critique of the criticism, the higher criticism as it's called. But it's still powerful and strong in many quarters. It hasn't been demolished or destroyed. Although there's been a lot of criticism of it. Yeah. Andy.
Last year we had a speaker who had worked with Paul Tillich and subsequently renounced his views. I can't think of her name, but I'm wondering if
Gloria can tell you her name.
The question is, do you know if we had a copy of her comment or not? Because I found them very difficult to understand, and in light of our discussion, it might be interesting to be able to review.
Gloria, did she leave us with a paper? Yes. Oh, splendid. Uh-huh. Do you think that that's copyable? Oh, well, splendid. Maybe we could get a copy and make it available to as many as wished it. Good. Further. Now, Ed.
For those people at that time, or that was for those who experienced Christ.
Only for those who experienced it and responded in faith.
But for those who, but it actually was that for those who experienced it.
Yes.
Only
yes.
That point in time.
Or in any other point of time in which the kerygma is proclaimed, the gospel is proclaimed. The problem, of course, is the historical underpinnings of such a gospel. That's a problem, together with all the load of the theological ideas on top of it. Oh, Jeff.
I was wondering, how could Burma explain that they are 20 years from now, the future? At the time in Boston, and during those times, we started to visualize or even what the Burma has been. Meaning that itself, in every instance, New Testament has been deeply
how can we again
guarantee that these views are then ancient as the
new? He can't guarantee that. No. They're time bound also. Martin?
I'm not sure that you would really say they're time bound. I think Buddha would say Buddha lives in the understanding of time is top of the age. So you wouldn't say there's any development further away from an age where everything tends to be the apologized. And just live in the realm or in the time would mostly moved by science and by rational understanding.
Right.
So therefore, the demythologized theory, which has been come to certain statements about a new existence, and there will be no further development. So, in a sense, there will be no 20th century.
As far as substance, he would probably say that the form in which it might be expressed might change, say, from Heidegger's form in the terms that Heidegger uses, or the categories. There might be other categories used. Yeah. Andy?
I've got to repeat a question I asked you earlier today.
Okay.
And that is, what I'm hearing of existentialism is that it is a, well, there are absolutely no things. And yet we say we have an existential interpretation of the mythologized message. It seems to me the basic message is one of hope. The basic message of existentialism, it seems to me, is almost the opposite. And I'm trying to reconcile, I suppose, in my mind, what do we mean when we say an existential interpretation of the mythologized message? I don't understand that.
Yes. Not so much in terms of a wholesale taking over of, for instance, Sartre's atheistic principles and its renunciation of all absolutes. There we have to guard ourselves, because Bultmann would be a theistic existentialist. So you can't do, but taking over that part of Heidegger which emphasizes this distinction between authentic and inauthentic existence, and the gospel enables us to achieve authentic existence, existence, if you want to put it this way, existence as God intended it. It frees, the gospel frees, or it has the possibility, let's say, of freeing human beings to live authentically. Again, you can't take over all of Sartre's concepts, the denial of all absolutes. Yeah, that's a problem, I know. And yet, Sartre is not, Bultmann is not simply a follower of Kierkegaard either, with the absolute paradox. each one has a very distinctive approach to the whole issue. But I felt I had to mention the development of existentialism through Kierkegaard and Sartre, and still stress that Sartre was an atheist, and still emphasize parts of it that are atheistic-oriented and parts that are not. That's why I wanted to ask, what values are there in existentialism, say in a theistic existentialism, that evangelical Christians could look at and say, hey, does this have something to say to us? I wanted to at least open that question. Since we're talking about that, as we went through the essay on existentialism, and as we went through some of the material from Kierkegaard, even through Bultmann, perhaps you can think of some values in this particular view as a theology which has positive significance. Can you think of such? Gloria. Yes. Yes. Both those are very important. Both those are very important. Personal responsibility for what you are becoming. You know, that really gets into what Christ said about losing your life for my sake in the Gospels and finding it. Throwing away your life, living it for Christ's sake, living it outside of yourself for Christ and the Gospel's sake, and thus finding out what real existence, real life is all about. That is, life with the meaning that God intended for it. So it has some value there. And what Gloria mentioned about this fear of death, which freezes so many people into apathy, the fear of death, and really influences the way in which they live, the ways in which they express their life, the way in which they perhaps witness, the way in which they plan their life for Christ and their ministry perhaps as well. And that has a value. Can you think of other values besides those two? Bruce? Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's sort of part of that responsibility idea. Responsibility for what we are becoming. And to take responsibility for it. To realize that we have choices. Instead of simply saying, I'm satisfied with the status quo. You know, it enters into the Christian life. I'm satisfied with what I am. But the whole concept of growth in grace, the concept of growing towards spiritual maturity, implies that we make conscious decisions as to what we are going to become. And those are important decisions. I think existentialism emphasizes that as well. And that's good. That is to ferret out these values. Scott.
And I too, I was thinking myself as applying the scriptures more preaching. One of the needs that people have is to live authentically.
Yes.
To make sure that as we're preaching, make the application to live authentically.
Good. Good. Very good. Anything else? Yes, Linka.
That's also a good insight. However, perhaps the Christian life offers a little more optimistic outlook than Sartre's outlook, for example. Should we take a break or should we end at 12:10? Seems almost a rhetorical question. Paul.
Sartre and saying, if there is no God, there are no absolutes, and if life, and if there is a God, then there is meaning to life, and there are absolutes, and there is life, and there is no absolutes. It's the other side of the coin, as far as that is about if there is no God. And if there is God, we have a logical
I think you'd probably have to say that values, if there is no God, are anchored in man's choices. And if there is a God, then values are anchored in God, ultimately. So whether you're talking about the truth or goodness or beauty, there's an anchor, there's a base, there's a touchstone. And that's quite different, obviously. All right, got a couple of... Yes, Ed.
Discussing the stars, and I was just thinking about it is that what I was wondering if he, as part of his philosophy, he would claim that in some way that individual person, or at least he, claims that issue and had absolute complete knowledge, so that they
No, he would not claim that. Of course, to affirm a universal negative, one would have to be omniscient. But if he says that no one is omniscient, but nevertheless this is the way things are, putting the burden of proof on theists to prove that there is a God, that's in effect what he does. And in his own milieu, he has not found sufficient evidence for the belief. Well, I've got a couple other things we have to do today. I'm pressing on, you see, because we've got to make up some ground. I have some midterm exam review questions, which no doubt you'll be happy. Well, I'm not sure happy is the right word. And then I want to say a word about the midterm that will be of help to you. Everybody's here today. That's wonderful. It's the first time that's happened. No one has to take one for anyone. An excellent method. Now, some helps. We're not going to spend time on this today, but just some helps. First of all, you notice it says there will be three lists of nine questions in each list. You can't choose one from one list and one from another list. You have to take all the questions in one list. Okay? If you choose list one, you have to do all the questions in list one. List two, all the questions. All right. Each of the three lists adds up to 107 points. Now, if some of you really go-getter computer people want to try to figure out a program that would enable you that would enable you to discover what combinations of questions, out in the margin you see in the parentheses, it gives you the values of the questions. If some of you would want to try to figure out a computer program that could figure out what three lists of questions would total 107 points, that would be fun, but it might take you a while. We had a student who's now in Harvard, and he worked out a computer program, And honestly, it must have 8 pages of solutions. He spent more time working out that program than it would have taken to study all the questions for the exam. But he did it in fun. He was a very bright student anyway. The following questions appear on all three lists. You might want to make a note of this. Question 1 and question 16 on all three lists. I wouldn't remember this if I were you. I'd write it down. I mean, you can do as you choose, but I wouldn't try to remember it unless you have a marvelous memory. 1 and 16 will be on all three lists. You cannot avoid them. Number 2, the following questions appear on 2 of the three lists. 2 of the 3. I'm not telling you which 2. I mean, you know, there could be any combination of 2. Okay. Number 2. Number 3. Number 5. Number 9. Number 10. Number 13. Number 14. Those appear on 2 of the 3 lists. 2, 3, 5, 9, 10, 13, and 14. And then all the others appear on only one list. Now, what some students in the past have found to be very helpful is if there's a question they particularly don't want to answer, okay? And it doesn't appear on 2 lists, so they know it only appears on one list. Then when they come to the time of the examination, they look for the list that doesn't have that in it. Okay? And there are 2 out of the 3 that won't have it in it. In them. So then they pick one of those lists that doesn't have that question in it. So that's one way to work it. There are all sorts of clever things that students do to work things, you know. I was a student myself. Well, those are the things that may be of help to you. Number 16 is a pretty powerful question, 40 points. That's a lot of value. And it's a thought question. You have to think it through. You have to develop your answer to that. I'm not going to give you the answer to that. You're going to have to work it out. Now, if you want to study with other students, that's fine. If you want to make up a cell of 5 or 6 students and you all study together and all share your, I was about to say ignorance, but I won't say that. You share your wisdom and your knowledge. Feel free to do so. You may help each other. You may mislead each other. But hopefully in the multitude of counselors, wisdom will appear. Hopefully. Okay, now, from here on until the midterm, which is June 19th, say that's only 10 days from now. That's terrible. Well, anyway, from now until then, you may ask me questions on the review question. But don't ask me to give you the answer, okay? You may ask me questions as to what the question means, and I'll explain it. I'll go out of my way to explain it. But I won't just give you the answer so you can jot down the answer and then give that back to me after you memorized it. David.
I haven't really tried to think of this back, but are there other questions? I assume that we'll take more questions than what we have on this page.
All the questions in the midterm exam are on this sheet. All of the questions on this sheet will appear on one of the lists or more. So you have the midterm exam in front of you, except for the 3 lists. You have everything except the 3 lists in front of you. So you can think about these things ahead of time. You can study them. You can work your way through them. The purpose of handing out review questions is twofold. 1, to cut down on the vast amount of material that we're covering. And 2, to focus on the things I consider to be the important things, the highlights. So if you'll take those two purposes and keep them in mind, that should help you a great deal. All right? And remember, you can ask me questions from now until the last class. Don't call me up the night before. Don't call me up at midnight before, you know, don't do that, please. Or don't come up to me just as we're about to begin the examination and ask me a question. Do that ahead of time, all right? Please. Now, let's make a beginning. Process theology. The liberation theologies. What is process theology? You can see from your reading that it has a philosophical background. On page 59, I've listed some philosophers and theologians, including Alfred North Whitehead and Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, whose name is not pronounced Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. And Charles Hartshorne, and then some of the people who are considered theologians, Norman Pittenger, whom I've quoted from, Schubert Ogden, and Daniel Bay Williams, John B. Cobb Jr., and so on. What is process theology? Alfred North Whitehead wrote a book which emphasized the idea that the ultimate reality in the universe is process, movement, development, becoming, a becoming. Everything's in process. Now that fit nicely with the idea of evolution, evolutionary development. Process theology says not that God is distant, has created the universe, set it going, and now stands back and serenely contemplates it. A self-existent, self-running universe with its inherent laws. No, no. Process theology says, neither, on the other hand, is the universe God. The universe is not God. Neither deism, God is distant, God is other, nor pantheism, God is everything, the universe is God. No. Process theology says, God is in everything. Of course, theism says the same thing. God is in everything. But the difference is, to express it in the vision that Teilhard de Chardin had, de Chardin was a Jesuit, an anthropologist, a theologian, philosopher of sorts, and Chardin had an experience. When he was out on a field trip, he picked up a rock. And as he held the rock in his hands, the conviction came to him that God was in the rock. But not just that God was in the rock, because a theist can say, God is omnipresent. God is everywhere. God is in the rock. But he believed, and I think this comes something or somewhat out of his Roman Catholic theological orientation, he believed not only that God was in the rock, but that God was in mystical union with the rock. That there was a union between God and the rock. And so that he held in his hands, in a sense, God in union with this rock. Process theology says that there's a very real relationship between God and the universe. They're in union with one another. God is not the universe. The universe is other than God, but yet they're in union with one another. And just as the universe is developing evolutionarily, so God is developing. God is in process. Process theology says, in a sense, God is prior, but not in a temporal sense. God is developing in parallel with the universe, but yet, in a sense, he lures the universe on to its final destiny. He spoke a great deal of human destiny. Wrote a book by that title. The Phenomenon of Man, another book. God was leading man toward the end point of his own ideal development. But he was doing so not through physical force or simply by laws. He was doing so through love. God is luring the universe toward its final destiny through love. But both God and the universe are developing. God is in an evolutionary process of development, just as the universe is. Process theology. That's basically what it is. Now, of course, there are a lot of details, a lot of refinements and nuances, and I'm dreadfully oversimplifying in the interest of time and because you've read this material, which is admittedly brief. God and the world are interdependent. So that even though God lures the universe on, he's interdependent with the universe. As it develops, he develops. As he develops, it develops. Interdependence. And Christ is the omega point. All process will ultimately culminate in the omega point. So that when man finally becomes ideally what God intends him to be, not forces him, but lures him by love, then we will have reached a point at which the universe and God unite, and man and God unite. The omega point. The goal of all evolution. I have four articles here on the liberation theologies, and I want to make sure you get those. So rather than let the time completely slip out, if I could have four people help me, we'll give out these articles. Two of them are on liberation theology in the general sense, that is the political liberation theology. One is on black liberation theology. One is on feminist liberation theology.
David.
What is theology today? I'm not familiar with that. Looked it out, and I've seen a lot of quotes from it before.
I don't recall specifically the background of the organization that puts it out. We get it here.
It's an American publication.
As far as I know, yeah.
David.
Make sure you get four. Make sure you get four. Two on liberation theology. One on black theology by the foremost black theologian of our time and by one of the foremost feminist theologians of our time, Rosemary Radford Ruther. Now, thank you so much for helping me get through a pile of material today. Admittedly, sometimes only scratching the surface. I want to talk a little bit about these liberation theologies, and I still want to say a word or two about chapter one of Lewis and Demarest. But I'll keep those on the front burner, Lord willing, for next time. And we'll say something very quickly about approaches, about divisions of theology, about the necessity, although that's fairly straightforward. And then we'll get into method, which is very important. Method, theological method. An area that's suffered a great deal from lack of treatment. So we need to spend some solid time on method. So the rest of Thursday, Lord willing, and Friday, we'll be talking about theological method. And before that time, you will have read John Warwick Montgomery's marvelously crafted paper, The Theologian's Craft, and it's a long paper. And then we can do something with that. All right? We'll see you, Lord willing, Thursday.